Welcome to Let's Take This Offline, a brand new podcast from the Australian HR Institute. My name is Shelley Johnson. I'm a proud RE member, and I've spent over a decade leading HR teams and helping to create positive work cultures. Whether you're on your commute, taking a lunch break, or looking for inspiration, this podcast aims to share meaningful conversations and actionable insights that leave you feeling inspired, informed, and ready to take action. One of the things keeping employers and HR leaders up at night is the need to upskill and reskill employees in order to keep pace with the changing business environment. RE's 2023 September Quarter Work Outlook report showed that one in five respondents didn't feel their employees were proficient in their current roles. The upskilling agenda is likely to become even more critical this year as organisations do their best to respond to the changing nature of work brought about by the rise of AI technologies. But often, learning and development and HR professionals face barriers getting people engaged in the programs that they invest so much time, effort, and money into. So how can we create a program that actually gets cut through? We're talking about this with today's guest, Rod Farmer, who's an associate partner at McKinsey & Co. and has worked extensively on future of work strategies with companies all over the world. In this conversation, Rod is going to share his thoughts on how we can change our mindsets and dialogue around reskilling. And he offers an interesting case study that delivered impressive results that I know any HR professional listening will find value in. Rod, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm really keen to dig into this topic with you today, Rod, because I know you've got such great expertise in this space. But first, I want to zoom out and ask, what advice would you offer to any HR professional listening about how they can get cut through with their learning and development program?
I would say the number one thing that I would do was to get them to focus on contextualized upskilling and reskilling rather than self-paced digital opt-in learning for a couple of good reasons. So upskilling and reskilling, what we see is it's one of the most profound systematic ways of which an organization can achieve a triple dividend. And a triple dividend is where you're driving revenue or performance, you're taking out cost, and you're actually having a social benefit, an employee benefit. So let's think about this. We know that when you do upskilling, reskilling right, there's a 4x improvement in performance. There's a 2x improvement in employee retention, which is churn, which is cost, and there's a barrier to productivity and a whole range of other things. And we also know that there's about a 10 to 15% improvement on employee satisfaction, which then also has a net-net effect on culture. Now, this doesn't happen with self-directed learning. Self-directed learning, the global average for self-directed digital learning from opting into a program to completing that program is 13%. Only 13% of people who go on to an online or self-paced or digital learning even complete it. That's a huge amount of wasted capital, energy, emotional energy within an organization around learning and cultural development for L&D. Right. And so I would say my number one thing is take a step back and really think about how we can take a much more contextualized upskilling, reskilling approach.
It's such interesting data as well to hear that of those self-paced online learning courses that on average, it's only a 13% completion rate.
That's exactly right. But it's also not too surprising in the sense of, well, who are those 13%? They're probably a little bit more motivated, self-motivated. It's not related to the job. It's independent of the job. It wasn't curated and crafted for a particular enterprise or company or particular situation for the employee. So it's not as relevant. And the final thing is that upon completion of that, there's very little recognition and reward. And yes, we can talk about micro certifications and badges and a whole bunch of other things. But at the end of the day, people really want to be able to apply something in the day-to-day job, be recognized and rewarded by their managers, by their leaders, by the organization. And when the thing that you're learning is completely independent of how you're being actually asked to do your job, why would you complete it? Why would you opt in? Why would you do it? And so I don't think we need to, you know, over-intellectualize this, but I think there's a fairly easy cycle to understand about what's broken.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I guess I wanted to kind of dig into, because you've had so much practical experience in this space. And I know in RE's September Work Outlook report, it showed that one in five respondents felt their employees weren't proficient in their roles. Does that statistic surprise you, or do you feel like that's something that you're seeing across the board?
Well, it's definitely something I'm seeing across the board, and I'm never too surprised when I hear of any statistic that says that we're lacking critical skills within our workforces, because this is something that we see globally. I'm very fortunate to work on these sorts of problems across multiple continents. And what I see fundamentally is that in almost every country, there's a really low degree of investment in talent and workforce development as a percentage of GDP. So if we step back a little bit, COVID, post-pandemic, great attrition, you know, huge transitions and upheavals within sectors, sustainability, like huge shifts towards climate change. These are major shifts, but we're not investing in our talent and our workforces. So I don't want to draw too strong a correlation here, but it kind of begs the question of the funding and investment's not there. Should we expect to see enough skills within the workforce, in the workforce? The second thing that I'm seeing that doesn't surprise me whatsoever is that we're seeing a shift between a jobs-based economy to a skills-based economy. So it used to be that you would learn a job and become proficient in a job, but organizations now want far more flexibility and resilience from the workforce, which means they want to be able to tap into people's, you know, current and latent skill sets. And so when we start to think about, well, are there people with deficiencies in their skills? It's going to become more and more the norm as people look beyond a traditional job description or a role into the set of skills that they need, right? And so we need people with more varied skills at greater degrees of proficiencies. And so as we start to ask people to be more varied and flexible in their jobs, we're going to find that that's, you know, more of a challenge. But that's where we're headed, you know, skills-based economy rather than jobs-based economy.
I mean, it's interesting because we have this challenge of, well, the data shows us that the organization isn't as proficient or skilled as we want, but then you make the comment of, well, we're not investing in talent. So we've got this kind of dynamic of, well, how do we increase the skills without that investment? And I'd love to know, and I think this is really clear, that reskilling based on the future of work, based on how fast things are changing, it's one of the most business critical things that organizations need to do right now. But so often we hear that the learning and development programs aren't getting cut through or they're not getting results. And so I think that's why there's this tendency not to invest, because we're like, well, those programs, they aren't driving the change or they aren't giving us the results we're after. So why do you think that's happening, and how could we adjust our reskilling efforts to get that return that we're after?
There's probably two things, one at a more strategic level and one at a very practical level. So what I would say is at a strategic level, and this has been a shift over the last couple of years, and not to throw more stats, but what we've seen is just through that sort of COVID pandemic, post-pandemic area, we've actually seen a 25% year-on-year increase in the demands for upskilling and reskilling within the workforce. So just a bit of a context, we are on an upwards trajectory to recognizing the sort of changes that need to take place within the organization. So where we sit right now is roughly around about 60% of all CEOs, compared to about 30% about 5 years ago, say that, you know, improving skills proficiency within the workforce is a top three priority. Right, that's a huge shift from the top down, right? When you query your top-level executives and you say, you know, if you were to name the five or six big levers that you could pull to really drive organizational performance and productivity, what would they be? And I won't list them all out, but I want to say is about, you know, number two at about 85% of all respondents is upskilling and reskilling. Now, there is still a delta between what we're now recognizing from a strategic level and seeing it being pulled through the organization. So let's recognize we're not there. Your words and intents and actions often work at different timescales. That's a fundamental shift. And so I think what's being recognized is as organizations need to shift, they're going to need to set different strategic goals. And those different strategic goals are going to need to be met by a more skills-based workforce, which is then raising the aha moment of, I think we're going to have to be a lot more strategically focused on our L&D activities. And I think maybe that's, you know, music to most HR and L&D professionals' ears, but what it really means is you are mission critical to the future of that organization. If you're going to have to, you know, if you're going to have to avoid significant disruption of your core business, if your industry or sector is going to go through an upheaval, you're going to have to change your operating model, You might need to deliver different products or services. Your people are going to have to work in different ways. They're going to have to adopt these skills quickly and on the job, which then gets me to my last, you know, my second very, very practical thing is we need to, and there's many different ways you can embrace this, but I would say take on a lot more jobs to be done approach or contextualized approach to skills building. So I think about the sort of the holy trinity of upskilling and reskilling as formal, social, and on the job. So we're very good at formal. The problem is that with formal learning, the andragogy of it all, is that we went from sort of face-to-face classroom-based learning, which has its pros and cons, to let's just go digital, right? But what we didn't also bring about was where's the social? Mm. Where's the peer-to-peer learning? Where's the actual interaction with the rest of the organization? And where's the on-the-job that, you know, what I'm learning is relevant to what I'm trying to do day-to-day, which other people can observe and tell me if I'm doing better or worse. And it gives me a sense of security in my job or job progression or opportunity for salary advancement. You get this virtuous cycle of the organization's moving forward, but you're moving forward. So number one is the big change is it's now a strategic priority. We need to see that flow from, you know, belief through to intent and action. And the second part is I think we do need to get back to a little bit more hybrid learning, but most importantly, these missing elements of social and on the job, which I think we've let fall between some cracks as we just made a huge jump to digital online.
I'd love to dig into this on the job piece because most HR professionals know the 70-20-10 model. We've all like recited that in various meetings with managers where 70% of learning happens on the job, 20% through mentoring and coaching and 10% in classroom or kind of formal learning styles. I'm just curious, what does good on-the-job learning look like that practical component of how do we help our employees learn and reskill on the job?
My personal view is I'm a very big proponent of apprenticeship. And maybe I'll talk about this in more detail a little later on with a case study sort of wrapped around it to bring it to life. But when we talk about on the job, like there's a couple of questions of have we actually tried to understand what that individual is trying to do on a day-to-day basis? What is their context of use? Who are they interacting with? What are the actual set of activities and steps that they need to perform in order to do that job? What are the enablers that they require? And when we talk about the skills, skills is a very big term, right? Skills are made up of competences and competences are made up of proficiencies. Like, have we actually stepped back and said, in order for you to do your job in your context of use, this is what you need to do and this is what good looks like for you and this is the step ladder that we want to take you on. And when you tailor learning to that, that's when you get a lot more cut through than when we're just saying, let's take the learning out into the field, like field and forum. Like that's the cut through. And not to get too academic about this, but if I go back to the old sort of principles of scaffolded learning, you want to give somebody something that is just a little bit harder than what they're currently able to do, scaffolded or supported by the right structures, people, enablers, content, technology, to enable them to get to that next level of performance and then keep them there, habituate it, and then move them forward again. You can't do that if you don't deeply understand what they're trying to do within their job and where they're operating. So when I say on the job, I'm talking about deeply rich understanding of the human doing the job and tailoring the learning to them, which obviously has implications for scale as well. Right?
I love that idea of apprenticeship because I'm just thinking back to that model of, and we apply it to trade, which is where a lot of our minds go when we think apprenticeship. We think this, the master, the apprentice, this four-year process and journey you go through. And exactly what you said, Rod, each challenge is that little bit harder, but you're not overwhelmed to the point where you're completely out of your depth. It's that stretch process and you have someone who's there and their role is to coach you and give you the next project that takes you that little bit further.
That's exactly right. And it's a shift for most organizations. We've been there in the past. I think it needs a little bit greater focus within the workforce these days as well.
Are there some key factors that you find are really important for organizations if they want to create a learning environment or a learning culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's hard to create a really strong learning culture if you haven't defined what are your strategic goals and the talent needs within those goals. Because there's a lot of role modeling and influencer modeling that comes down from the executives. This is important to us. This is why what you're doing is important. Can you see that importance in the thing that you're doing day to day? Can you recognize your contribution? So the first part is always like, are we clear on our strategic goals and where skills and talent development fits into this? And more than strategic workforce planning, right? This is just real concrete. What are we trying to achieve? And that next part is, again, what I've just mentioned perhaps with on the job, but it's that supportive and social on the job environment. And that's where coaching comes in. I think coaching is a critical enabler. Mentoring and coaching to creating these learning environments, I think, is really important. And I think engagement of managers and leaders is another one. I mean, if you sit back from any research that you do, people will tell you one of the hardest things to commit to learning is getting time away from the job and, you know, getting time away from your leaders and managers. So bringing them into the process and helping them understand how individual growth equals organizational performance. Your people better performing drives organizational performance, enables you to perform better as a manager and a leader. It's one thing to say, you've got to be in the process to really embody that. Yeah,
you're so right there. And I think getting that leadership buy-in, getting them on the journey, going back to the master and the apprentice concept, the role of that manager is so crucial in the learning piece. And I think sometimes for HR professionals, we feel like learning and development sits in a section within our team and we're the sole people responsible for it, instead of really getting that culture right where, hey, we need a dynamic here within this business where we're all learning, we're all committing to it. And so it's encouraging to hear you talk about the CEOs who are now really committed to reskilling, because that says to our HR teams, there's value here, this is going to be a core priority. And now I think for us, it's about how do we get the learning structure and programs right to generate the value and bring about the change when it comes to those skills and that proficiency. And I think the point you make, Rod, about mentoring is so important. I'd add that as HR professionals, we need to be engaging in coaching and mentoring ourselves, because a lot of this reskilling work is new territory. ARI has a great mentoring program for its members that I'd encourage you to check out. And I know for me, when I first started as an HR manager, I joined that mentoring program and mentored an HR grad who was working in Sydney. And it was just such a good experience for both of us. So jump on, check it out. And also, the ARI LinkedIn Lounge is a great place to get a bit of a temperature check on what your HR peers are doing in this space. I want to ask you, because you've got this amazing case study with the Department of Regional New South Wales that I think will really help people to get that understanding of what this could look like. And I think for me, sometimes when I've thought of reskilling programs, I've often imagined big enterprises getting their people across all these emerging technologies. But I'd love to hear about the case study from Department of Regional New South Wales, where you were working with them and their employees in sectors like agriculture and infrastructure. Can you tell us a bit about that process?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll provide a bit of context first, and to all of my dear NSW friends, hopefully listening to this, thank you for letting me speak on your behalf. So let's just go back to COVID just a little bit. So if we think about what DRNSW was standing for in terms of its sort of critical tenets, it was service simplification, innovation, and productivity through digital and AI, digital and automation. So simplification, innovation, productivity through digital. Along comes COVID. We changed the way that we work, remote work. All of a sudden, we start to see capability gaps within the workforce. We start to see some real issues with digital literacy. And importantly, we also start to see issues with digital inclusivity, which is what we don't talk a lot about when we start thinking about remote and hybrid ways of working, a real sense culturally of the haves and the have-nots, those able to participate and those who feel like they can't really participate. So all of a sudden, we had this organization that's incredibly diverse and dispersed, and really importantly, we keep these jobs flourishing in regional and rural New South Wales, who are struggling to participate culturally and functionally. So that was the context. And so the Department of Regional New South Wales wanted to understand and appreciated, we're going to have to raise our capabilities, but how do we go about it? Do we go about creating these programs and then mandating that people come into the programs? Is that the way forward? But they recognized that people were so diverse that, well, if I mandated it, I've got so many different people. How do I mandate these different types of individuals to come in? Right? So what we did is effectively, and I'll go through the nature of the program, but we went out and we started off by doing a human-centered design evaluation of DRNSW. So A human-centered design approach is where you take a very deeply empathetic approach, a very contextualized approach, where you go out and you see how people do their work, who do they talk to, you listen to their pains, their fears, their problems, you have really long conversations, not in a lab, but actually out where they're doing their job, and you see what really matters for them and what you need to do to help them do their job. So that was the human-centered design approach. So what we did is we went through and we effectively created these personas across the organization. Groups of individuals had very similar traits, not just by where they worked, whether it was the office or out in the field, if they're older or younger, but behaviorally, they behaved in very similar ways. So we created all these personas that were defined behaviorally rather than through classic criteria such as age or location in the office versus out in the wild. And those personas described the behaviors of the different people within DRNSW and what they would need. And from that, we then went into those personas and then we started to define the jobs to be done by those individuals to a relatively significant degree of specificity. And associated with that, what are the skills? And we built a whole skills framework. What are the skills families? What are the skills? What are the competences? What are the level of proficiencies? And then we worked with managers and leaders. What do you need? What's great going to look like? Okay, where do they sit on that proficiency level? And we effectively, my words, created a contract. The organization needs this. Your people need this. This is how they're working. This is how they're feeling. This is how they're thinking. They can't do something they're not ready to do. We need to bridge the gap between where they are now and where you need them to be. As a manager and a leader, where do you need them to be now and in the future? Therefore, what can you offer? And how are we going to make it clear on this ladder of how they step up? And that's how we started off the program. And to bring a little bit of color to that, when we went out, we were asking people, why aren't you completing your timesheets? Why aren't you saving your work back to the SharePoint file server? These are individuals who were actually walking around in many instances, for example, in the farmers, with pencil and notebook in their back pocket, refusing to use their mobile phones, not really wanting to use their laptops, who what we didn't understand previously had actually been taking their insights into the field and asking friends to do all of their administrative work, do the timesheets for them, write emails for them. They had been really smart in finding really creative ways to do their job effectively and overcoming that digital literacy issue. And that's what we uncovered. And when you play that back to the Department of Regional New South Wales saying, we've got people who actually haven't sent an email in the last 3 months. This is what we're talking about. They don't know the systems. That was the real eye-opening moment. And it explained a whole bunch of issues that they'd had as well.
It's amazing to hear the level of detail that you went to understand the challenges. I think sometimes the risk when we're trying to get to an outcome, so it's, let's say we want to increase the digital literacy, we move too quickly to let's do the course. Let's just get everyone to do the course or to tick the box because we want to get to the outcome quickly. But I love what you're saying, Rod, about the fact that you went and really understood the challenges. What are the unique things for each of those personas, each of those groups? What might be some of the things that the roadblocks that they might have? And if we want to reskill the workforce, we need to understand those because those things are not going to change without us understanding them first and then move forward before you get to designing the program. Because I think the fun, like sexy part of HR sometimes is let's design all the cool programs. But if we haven't understood the real pain points or problems, that program very well may not land.
That's exactly right. And you said something just before about, you know, racing to an outcome. My question is always, well, is the outcome completion or is it impact? Right? And if it's about impact, then it's a very different set of questions you need to ask and understand in order to get to impact. Completion can be enrollment, adherence, completion rates, time on task, all those classic things, which can get to a very high level of completion. But if those individuals don't perform at a better level, if they're not more satisfied, if they don't feel more supported, then they're ultimately not going to perform. And if performance is the impact, if it's the impact measure, that's very, very different.
Yeah, that is such a shift in your mindset to go from thinking about outcome to thinking about impact. So tell us about the program. What did you do next?
So after we sort of stepped back and said, okay, so what are the strategic goals of the organization? And do we have like a skills framework that we've built? How do we understand people? How do we understand skills? How do we measure skills? Like within the framework, We then set out to develop, and we did this to really build belief, right? And I'm a big believer in MVPs, you know, minimum viable products. Let's do enough to build belief. Is we actually created an alpha beta program, which is something that you do typically in different areas of government as well. The first alpha, the smallest possible thing you can do to get a small cohort to test the materials, learn about the approach, learn about the efficacy before then say, now let's do the beta, let's do the first real one before we scale it. So we made a choice to look at a particular sort of cohort and we structured that cohort. You know, the different types of learners, this very similar sort of behaviors we're looking for, their ability to commit. Again, we're tailoring the training to the types of people, not just having learned and said, yeah, but great, here's the course anyway. Like really listening to those needs and tailoring that training to the cohort and then putting them through that first 4 weeks of an alpha for us all to learn. Now, as part of that, we hit the number one classic problem, which is sort of nobody subscribed. So the question was, so do we mandate it? Do we reach out and we tell the managers that they have to send people? And we said no, this has to be also a test of where this is attractive and it's seen as something that they want to do. So we went down a bit of the sort of behavior design scarcity principle of, you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. It's a very small group of people, 25 only from all of the 5,000 employees who are eligible, who can attend. And we'd love for you to kind of put up your hand. And we got oversubscribed and that was great. And that first 4 weeks was to learn all about the coaching, the peer-based, the formal learning, exactly 7, 20, 10. And at the end of that, we learned a lot of things. Number one thing is by far and away, and it's always the case, it's always relearning the same knowledge nugget, coaching. Coaching is the number one thing. We had employees crying. This is the first time anybody's ever spent this time with me. It's the first time I ever felt like I was being listened to. The fact that I could come together with other people and see that they weren't learning, like I wasn't learning, and that someone took the time just to talk me through it and tell me that it was okay, right? The fact that what I was being asked to do was at my level for what I needed to do didn't make it feel as overwhelming. And we've got these beautiful videos of the process where by the end, people are literally overwhelmed with emotion around how they felt supported for the very first time by their organization from a learning and development perspective. And that's not to say that people didn't have the intention or the energy or the effort in the past to make them feel supported. But it's just the shift that comes about through that coaching atmosphere. And so that then led into the beta program where we amplified that coaching. And so we brought a lot more sort of the face-to-face, one-on-ones, group-based coaching. We brought back in the managers and the leaders into that coaching model. And then we went up to 75 learners in those cohorts and we scaled that as well. Throughout this entire process, we put in place a whole new measurement, evaluation and recommendation system. How are we measuring their emotional readiness? How are we measuring the interaction with any of the digital platforms? Measuring interactions with coaches, 360 feedback with coaches? How are we measuring the actual skills uplift? Measuring when they do the skills activities, is it at the last minute, the start of the week, like generating all these behavioral analytics. So at the end of this, we could say, and these are the results, right? 100% of every learner who went through completed the program, 100% had a 20 to 40% uplift in skills. We had a 90% over the course of this program, 90% satisfaction rate, 90% plus of people saying that they had improved their skills on the job, self-reported. Right, 75% increase in people saying that they would increase their tenure with DRNSW, so they would like to stay longer. And these are all self-reported. But we also built an analytics engine where we could see where. And the nice thing about what we built there is it could present us with behavioral cues. Did you know that group A is less engaged than group B? And looking at this behavior, we can see they're now more at risk of not completing the program. And here's some behavioral design recommendations for how to re-engage them at the coaching level. And we could see this in real time at an individual, within group, between group, throughout the program, and report that to coaching and managers, but also report that up to CHROs at different levels. And this created an enormous amount of buy-in. And the last thing I'll share about this, again, coming back to coaching, is when it started to scale, what we didn't plan for but happened quite naturally is the people who had gone through those first alpha and beta course put their hand up to be the coaches for the next round. And then the organization itself asked for the courses to be part of the onboarding process, which you had never imagined. We'd never thought about it as being a mandatory onboarding. And so when you think about this thing, this
supportive, social, on the job has led to greater cultural buy-in, huge emotional, you know, uptick, and organizational change, which doesn't naturally come about when you go through self-paced learning activities.
Those results are amazing. I'm curious, and I might be getting too much in the detail here, but humor me for a second, indulge my curiosity. When you describe that learning program, what did that actually look like from a day-to-day investment of that employee's time? Like, what were they doing? What were the practical things? You mentioned it was 4 weeks for the initial cohort. What does that 4 weeks involve?
So it was, you know, the development of project briefs and daily missions. So breaking something that they want to learn down into something very practical that they can see they need to do in their job. So it's the act or activity of performing something in their job, which is actually underneath the surface tied to the proficiency we're wanting to develop in the skill. So it's more covert than overt. Then there was bi-weekly sessions with the coaches, as well as the asynchronous connections with the coaches. So getting together in small groups twice a week, getting together one-on-ones to actually talk about the progress. So now you've got the on-the-job, project-based, mission-driven. You've got manager touch points every fortnight. You've got the coaching twice a week. And then we had a formal assessment where we would open it up halfway through the week, not at the start of the week. Some of these things can be a little self-evident, depending on the cohort. So you don't want them to race through on a Monday and sort of rush the analysis. We want the formal to be at the end. So we would have a baselining at the start where people would assess, self-assess their skills, and then do a few tests so we could really gauge where they are. And then at the end, we would do that sort of 20 minutes of formal assessment purely to see how they're performing, as well as to get some digital analytics out the back of that as well. So that's really what it looked like on a week-by-week basis with a sort of a capstone sort of mini project at the end of the 4 weeks as well to sort of encapsulate everything that they'd done. So if I step back from this, many people will be looking at this thing. It sounds a lot like Field and Forum. Well, it is. There's a lot of elements of Field and Forum, but it's also the project and mission-driven aspect. It's the social and coaching aspect of it. It's making sure that the formal is just a touch point, not the actual objective, and that you're doing things at regular increments, not just big bang. So we cared about the uplift throughout and the behaviors throughout just as much as we did about the ultimate uptick in proficiencies. And I think sometimes we can get a little bit hung up on the big end answer that we get, maybe at a yearly level. And what we really cared more about is just behavior change, how people learning to love learning.
Wow, that is such a good behavioral change, learning to love learning. For those who don't know Field and Forum, can you just give us a little insight into what that refers to?
So Field and Forum, quite simply, is just where you're doing activities out in the field. So it could be a little mini project, could be a task supported by others, sometimes not supported by others. And Forum is where you're coming back into structured, a bit more didactic activities, where it could be a lecture or 50 or 100 group of people coming back in for a workshop or, you know, some skills training, a little bit more sort of classroom based. So Field and Forum refers to the combination of those two things.
All right. So we've touched on this idea of people investing in L&D and that we need to see increased investment in learning and development. But the funny thing is, often I hear this rhetoric in HR and in businesses that L&D is the first thing on the chopping block when it comes to budget in tough economic times. What can HR do to demonstrate a return on investment when it comes to these kinds of initiatives?
Start small, demonstrate impact and scale. Right. So there is quite rightly a push to L&D to look at how they're trying to solve for the organizational needs. And that's very true. So you're trying to think about how you're scaling from the get-go. I think you need to demonstrate impact. You need to shift the culture around learning. So you need to turn up the dial on advocacy. And the way to do that is to start small, you know, be very clear on the outcomes you're achieving, why it's working, why it's special. Have those people celebrate and radiate those sort of learning outcomes and learning activities. And what that will do is build belief that these new ways of working, things that you're doing, are worth further investing in. And it might need some extra people. It might avoid the cost cutting. It might actually increase the spend in L&D, but then becomes the challenge of now, how do I effectively scale? When I go from company to company talking to them about the upskilling and reskilling, and they talk about L&D cost cutting and their very real concerns. When I ask, are you able to equate the learning outcomes to commercial performance and organizational benefits? Are you able to actually demonstrate the shift that that's had on culture? Do you actually know what are the set of skills that are required and how you'd actually build the programs to achieve very specific impact metrics? The answers typically come back as no. And so my provocation, and it is a provocation, is if you can't track it, if you can't measure it, if you can't link it to benefits, if you don't have any radiation of the success, if you can't show how you're going to be able to scale it up systematically, what suggests to you that you are warranting additional funding or to safeguard your existing funding? So why don't we change that? Why don't we sit back and go a little bit smaller and say, you know what's driving success? You are building advocacy. You can link it to value. And if we think, you know, if we go through some basic sort of upskilling, reskilling frameworks, and I won't go into them in detail, but from, you know, very basic learning acquisition to behavior change to organizational change, whether it's a 3 or a 5-stage model, right? If you can get to that difference of here's the specific change and results I've seen at the learner level, not just at acquisition, but behavioral change, and here's the organizational impact, that last part, by locking that in, you're in a much better position to say, and here's how we're helping on that strategic mission, and here's why the funding is required, and here's the return on investment. So example, DRNSW. So for organizations, as you heard before, that significantly invest in upskilling and reskilling, it's a 2x improvement on retention. Okay, let's say we only improve it by 2 to 3%. If DRNSW improved, which they did, their retention rates by just 2 to 3%, not 2x, just 2 to 3%, they would save, with a 30% margin, more from upskilling and reskilling, implementing an upskilling and reskilling, than dealing with churn. So put in other words, the cost of churn, productivity issues, so losing the employee, rehiring the employee, recruitment costs, you know, projects coming to a halt, cultural issues, the cost of losing employees was far greater than implementing the upskilling and reskilling program, still with a 30% margin on top, right? But you have to be able to demonstrate the benefits first so you can equate the benefits, so you can come back to the math and say, it's mission critical. It's not a nice to have. It's fundamental to driving the triple dividend: social benefits, cost efficiencies, and growth.
Hearing you unpack the commercial benefits, I think one of the challenges I found early in my HR career was being able to speak that language of showing the commercial impact of some of these people programs and learning programs that I would see them as mission critical, because I was always thinking about employee experience, always thinking about employee retention. But we need to, for HR listeners, we need to be able to speak to the financial benefits, to the commercial benefits, and speak really clearly, just as you did now. One of the things I've found we can do if we're in a smaller organization, where maybe we don't have as much access to some of the data analytics that we'd love to have, simple calculations on why are people leaving? What are they saying in their exit interview? What are they telling us about career progression? And we get a picture of, well, most or half of our people have left because there's not enough progression or sense of learning and growth. Okay, well, what does that cost us? Well, on average, it costs us 6 months of their salary. Well, what does that mean? Well, if we've lost 20 people, all of a sudden we have a number of how much that cost us. And it's a lot of money for a smaller organization.
I think being able to articulate the return on investment in real terms and hard costs is so important, but maybe something that we miss. So understanding how we can interpret and use the data will be a critical skill for HR going forward. And Ari has an awesome short course that's designed to help you learn how to mine that data, which I'll pop in the show notes, because this is a crucial skill for us to get right.
It's a very rare day when I talk to an organization who is trying to, not having solved, but trying to solve that link to value, right? So exactly what you said. So the better that you can track, monitor, and report the benefits, where those benefits can be equated back to commercial outcomes, because ultimately you're asking for money, so how are you saving money or generating money, is critical to scaling any sort of upskilling and reskilling program.
I can just see the Excel gurus who are listening right now thinking, I'm going to create an amazing spreadsheet that's going to calculate the churn rate. And for us to be able to go, cool, now we just need to put that into a really solid business case, take it to our CEO and get this learning and development initiative across the line. I've got a couple more questions for you. I was talking to a HR manager the other day, and they've put a freeze on learning spend in that particular organization. There'd been obviously some difficult things that have happened for them in their financial performance. And one of the challenges they mentioned was, how do I keep a focus on learning when I have no budget? Are there any kind of strategies you would recommend to that person listening for how they can creatively solve that challenge without having their budget set aside for it?
The question in my mind has two parts. Is, are you trying to accelerate learning into something that's already core to your business? In which case, do you really need external solutions, content, providers, dedicated separate activities? Or can this be set up in a way in which people are already doing their job? Or separately, are we actually trying to bring in new skills to the organization and fundamentally close a big skills gap, which can't be done by role modeling and apprenticeship and structured on the job learning? And that occasionally happens, and you often see that as part of major transformations, right? On the latter one, that's a really hard problem. It's just a perennial, very hard thing. On the first one, listen, I'll call out agile transformations as a great one. They're really big, complex things that can take place. People are shifting their operating model. They're shifting their job titles. They're going from, you know, job descriptions to contribution models in terms of how they're being thought about and evaluated and how they progress within an organization. But the way in which most of the agile skills, the core agile skills, the mindsets, the ceremonies, the fundamentals of how they plan their work, how that actually gets done is on the job. Led by a couple of core leaders who do have some upskilling, who role model, who put that into place, and who really implement those ceremonies themselves and ask others to follow them, and they get quite rigorous at ensuring those ceremonies are followed by role modeling, not by mandating. And again, agile transformations are great because if you did upskilling for a bank, you know, 30 to 50,000 people going through an agile transformation, if you wanted formal upskilling, reskilling for those individuals, it'd be hugely costly. But actually, most of those agile skills are borne out through the day-to-day interactions on the job with micro shifts in what they're doing. But it does take a leader to implement role model those small changes. So teaching from within, not from without.
On the leadership piece, is there anything that you feel is crucial for leaders in helping their teams learn?
Motivation and buy-in. So like, is this yet another thing to your day job, right? Is this something that you've been asked to do, or is by actually uplifting the skills of your team effectively enabling you to do your job and your organization's job tenfold better, right? And I said this earlier, and it's a flippant comment in many regards, or it could be taken as a flippant comment, but I actually believe it is. Organizational performance requires individual growth. You cannot significantly shift an organization's performance by willing it. You cannot shift it by talking about people development. It takes real investment at the individual level to see them improve their performance in very specific ways that are meaningful. If a leader is being tasked with achieving an outcome and they said that their people are critical to achieving that outcome, then you're far more likely to get cut through. If the leader or manager sees this as an organizational criteria or a particular OKR that's been set outside of any context, it's unlikely to succeed.
I love that point, Rod, and it's such a beautiful place to kind of land this conversation, that if you want your business or organization to grow, your people have to grow.
Yeah.
It's so simple, but I often think about leadership and think our leaders' growth has to outpace the growth that we want to see in the organization, because if we want to have this organization that is not going to be susceptible to disruption, that is able to change with these emerging technologies and respond to things that are happening, really complex situations in our environment, we need people in the business who are intrinsically motivated to grow. And I think that can be a big leadership challenge, but something that a lot of people will rise to, and that they can build that desire within their own teams to step into that growth zone.
Completely agree.
I've got a final question to wrap this up. At the end of each episode, we like our guests to respond to a made-up scenario that could be playing out somewhere in Australia right now. So here's yours, Rod.
Okay.
You work in HR for an organization that has a skills shortage issue, and you've been put in charge of coming up with a solution. The CEO has invested in an internal learning platform, but the engagement uptake is really low. The CEO suggests mandating training sessions, but you know from employee sentiment surveys that people don't find the training helpful. What do you do next?
The number one issue that I have with the scenario that I've just heard is the CEO invested in a platform, which is what the CEO was asked to do. But investing in a platform is not investing in your people. So ultimately, we've thought about a tool before the outcome or the impact. We talked before about impact. So there's naturally going to be a situation here of people don't like it, they're not using it. Why did I invest in the platform? Right? Rather than there's a different question, which is what do I want for my people? Why aren't they engaging with that? Right? So that's the first kind of shift I would make. Because the first thing that I would turn around is I would go, what is it that we're asking them to? I put a different program in place. What is it that our employees need? Not just need from a functional perspective, a skills perspective, but from a almost like a self-actualization perspective, an emotional perspective. What do they need? Job security, ability to promotion, reward and recognition, potentially salary advancement. Like, what do they need? Then I would develop a program that actually looks to tackle those needs against the organizational needs. Let's step back, not solve, you know, boil the ocean. What are a couple of the key pillars that we really need to make movement on as soon as possible? And it's always good to have a burning platform. I always think with organizations where something's gone wrong, there has to be something that's visible, it's near term, it's tangible, where you can show the results quickly, and that's something that the CEO cares about. So I'd find one of those things and I'd marry that with what our people actually need. And I'd build a program specifically designed to get the outcomes against those goals where the people feel very supported and are advocates in the outcome of that. And I would shift the dialogue towards impact and outcome. And then I'd be moving forward with a don't talk about tools and platforms, talk about people, outcomes, and advancement. And so I changed the dialogue. Any longer answer than that, I'm going to probably outline like a 2-3 year program for you. But that would be the first thing that I would do, because I walk into organizations all the time who say, well, we invested in these platforms over the last 3 years and nobody uses them, right? It's because you thought the tool was the answer. The tool is not the answer, right? The people are the answer and you've got to start with them.
What a way to close this conversation, Rod. Thank you so much for being part of this discussion. It's been, I feel like I've got so many things that I can take away and implement tomorrow. So thank you. Very practical.
Oh, you're very, very welcome.
I hope you're feeling really inspired after hearing from Rod. And I know you're going to have a lot of practical strategies to take away when it comes to learning and development. For me, there's three big takeaways. The first, moving from a job-based to a skills-based economy, being able to use data to influence decision makers to get buy-in for learning and development. And number three, the importance of coaching and apprenticeship when it comes to learning and development. Thanks for listening and check out the show notes for some resources to help you put these insights into action. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you give us a 5-star rating and follow so you never miss an episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian HR Institute. If you'd like to learn more about ARI, visit ahri.com.au. That's ahri.com.au.